Just out of remiss, I would like to speak to a commercial that played during the news break. It was sponsored by Salem Radio Network. It was on behalf of the Christmas candle. The byline was a little, it takes just a little faith to see the light. Yes, faith is necessary for religion because evidence and reason don't apply. Christmas is a purely pagan holiday. God was not born. God is. Christmas was the celebration of the birth of the Son of the Sun in the Babylonian religion, the Egyptian religion, the Greek religion, and then in the Roman religion. Typically, the Son of the Sun is considered the Son of God. Whether it be Tammuz, Ninus, then Tammuz in Babylon, Cyrus in Egypt, Dionysus in the Greek religion, Bacchus, and the Roman religion. It's interesting, of course, that Paul, when he cited the words of his Lord on the way to Damascus, quoted the most famous line ever uttered by Bacchus, Dionysus, Osiris, and Tammuz. That is, that it is difficult to resist and to kick against the goad. The goad is a sharp pointed object that that is used to manipulate and control dumb animals. It is the nature of religion, of course, is the goad. If you are akin to pagan religious holidays like Christmas and Christmas candles and faith, then I don't suppose there'll be much that I could say that's going to dissuade you, because you won't much like the words of God. Speaking of words, Max Lucado considers himself quite the wordsmith. In fact, if you want to go to Max Lucado's website, the first thing you'll read is, Max Lucado loves words. Spoken, written, it does not matter. He loves to craft sentences that are memorial, memorable, inspiring, and hopefully life-changing. Yes, it's the nature of all religious zealots. It's their words, the words that they craft, that they want to be considered memorable, inspiring, and life-changing. They rather dislike God's words. They're at war with God's words, but they love their own. Well, I'm not at war with God's words. I rather like them. He told us, behold, henna, which means pay attention, listen. I will bring about a flood of water upon the region, Eretz, the land, the territory, the area, to destroy all related humans, in whom a spirit was born and lives from beneath the heavens. All who are related in the region will expire. Paul admitted that he was demon-possessed, as did Muhammad, the founders of the world's two largest religions. Openly admitted that they were demon-possessed. God is saying here that they were not the first to be demon-possessed, that there was a spirit which was born and lives from beneath the heavens that drove them to such Hamas. Remember Hamas? God described that Hamas was so prevalent on the earth. Deceitful destruction, wanton violence, thievery, a attitude of malfeasance. And it was all born and lived as a result of the demonic spirit from beneath the heavens that possessed these individuals. Now, it is interesting that the word that I translated, region, Eretz, is often translated land, and it can mean earth, as in the sense of the ground. But Eretz is almost always rendered the whole earth, as in the entire planet, in terms of this flood, and that's not what occurred. It would have been impossible. Even God could not have done it. He could not have flooded the entire planet to the tops of the mountains. He did not do it. He could not do it. There would be no reason for him to do it. Matter of fact, would have been immoral. There were Homo sapiens living around the globe. But the Homo sapiens living around the globe had not used their nasama to invent religions and to league with the demons elsewhere. They were doing it in this region, from the headwaters to the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. This was the area that was corrupt. This was the birth of human civilization. This is the place that had to be cleansed for humanity to have any chance at redemption, of reentering the garden. And it was this region that God would flood, because this is where those related to Hasadan were now corrupting the earth. Primarily, Eretz means region, territory, realm, or area. In the creation and flood accounts, it is often presented as earth, which, with our modern worldview, is interpreted as the name of the planet as opposed to the ground or soil. And that has given the impression that the flood was designed to wipe out all life on earth, covering the entire globe right to the peaks of the tallest mountains. If God had wanted to say that the water would flood the entire world, rather than land or region, he would have used Tabel. Tabel means world, as in the habitable portion of our planet. Of its 36 occurrences throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, Tabel is translated world 35 times, and habitable portion of the planet once. Consider this distinction. Because before, previous to the time that the mountains, the hills, the ridges, the ranges were born, conceived through force of labor, upon the earth, upon the land or ground, and the world, Tabel planet, was brought forth violently, born from distress akin to labor pains and shaking and trembling. Its mountains are, of course, born through earthquakes and to the uplifting of tectonic plates. Even before time, you were infinitely powerful and always existed as God. This is Mizmor Song 92. It's a statement that, of course, God cannot be born, of course, that God cannot die. And it's speaking of how the mountains on this planet were designed, and that the land, the Eretz, was of the world, were raised violently to become mountains. Furthermore, in this passage, the second application of Haaretz precludes the rendering of the compound word as the earth, because it is preceded by Ba, meaning in. So to perpetuate the religious myth and to keep from sounding foolish, English Bibles ignored in and pretended as if all on were actually in the text. But it's not. God, therefore, is speaking of flooding a specific place, a basin of decay, where the descendants of Adam, Seth, and Cain had partnered with Hasatan, the adversary, to become corrupt tyrants. It was in humanity's interest to do this. It was the moral thing to do. It was the responsible thing to do. It was the loving and compassionate thing to do. It is never loving or compassionate to embrace, to accept that which is evil, that which is corrupting, that which is destructive, that which is violent. Which is why those who embrace socialist secular humanism, the most deadly religion in human history, Islam, the second most deadly, or Christianity, the third most deadly, rather than being compassionate and enlightened and civilized as they claim to be, are corrupt, perverted. They are unloving. They are immoral. This is further confirmed by the rest of the statement from Yahweh, at least if the words are presented accurately. Ruach means spirit. Yahweh tells us that they come in different varieties. There is God's, his messengers, and there are Satan's and his associates. Humans equipped with a nesama can choose to associate with either, to be born anew from above, from Shamayim, the heavens, in God's spirit, or from below, as God says here, in Satan's. Animals with merely a nephesh soul don't possess the discriminating judgment required to make such a choice. An animal can be a transient host for a spirit, but nothing more. This being known, we can be certain that we have translated basar correctly in this context. While it can mean life form or animal, generically, since the verse references a twisted and distorted ruach spirit, the rendering of descendants, blood relatives, or near kin, and related human flesh of Bashar, as we have discussed it in previous translations, is absolutely appropriate. So putting it all together, we can deduce that Yahweh decided to eliminate most every descendant of Adam, a.k.a. Nesoma man, in the region east of Eden. He felt compelled to do so because they had leagued with Satan and become corrupt beyond hope of repentance, change, or redemption. In this regard, I find it interesting that God chose Gawa, meaning to expire, to describe what was going to happen. The term is uncommon, appearing only 24 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And on several of those occasions, it is translated, give up the ghost. The related word, gur, even speaks of inhabiting temporarily so as to stir up trouble through quarreling and strife. So there's a spiritual implication here, I'll bet, and one that is a bit tormenting and anguishing. Gawa also tells us that Satan's associates were going to perish gasping for breath, which is the Hebrew word also for soul. Their bodies would become empty, hollow, and lifeless corpses, devoid of the demonic spirit. This, in turn, would cause the quarrelsome and troublesome spirits to be locked up, incarcerated behind a shut door, imprisoned, in a word. You see, spirits are eternal. Since they aren't mortal-like souls, the only penalty which can be afforded a rebellious spirit is to be imprisoned forever. And that is why the abyss, which is Sheol, was made for Hasatan and his fellow demons. In a passage, God has provided us with some useful guidance regarding this conflict between spirits. Those that are from Yahweh, his Malach, and those who were fallen, those beneath the heavens who were in league with Hasatan. Now, the reason that I said earlier that God was dealing with Nesalmaman east of the garden is because Yahweh has already told us where these bad boys had settled, even what they had done to engender his wrath. And he told us from whence they had come. The detail pertaining to Eden's location had been provided for this very reason, and we're going to capitalize now on what we have learned. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mists. If you recall, it was the headwaters of the four rivers that Yahweh directed our attention to in describing the location of Eden, placing it southeast of the Black Sea and west of the Caspian Sea. And since the two biggest rivers in Yah's list were the Tigris and Euphrates, it would be reasonable to include northern Mesopotamia in this realm. This is thus the Eretz region Yahweh intended to deluge, purging it of Satan's partners. However, not everyone had chosen poorly. Eight people, amongst tens, if not hundreds of thousands, perhaps even as much as a million, had elected to associate with Yah. I wonder if it is that ratio. That ratio is any different today. You know, Yahweh says that thousands have availed themselves of his mercy by observing his terms and conditions. And thousands amongst billions is one in a million. Well, maybe there were 8 million people alive from the headwaters of the Tigris-Euphrates rivers and the towns and emerging civilizations around the Black and Caspian Seas and down through the Mesopotamia all the way down to Ur of the of Summa. And if that is the same ratio that is being presented here with Noah and his family. And, of course, it is interesting that when God is saving Noah and his family, encouraging Noah and his family to participate in actually in their own salvation in the sense that they are saved because they pay attention to Yah's instructions and they act upon them, that it was because of Noah's behavior, his attitude, his support for his family, that he was chosen by God, making the family the single most important thing, the one thing that God was trying to save, because the covenant is God's family. these eight people were based upon God's affinity to his covenant. Now, speaking to Noah, the trustworthy guide and the means to restoration, translating his Hebrew name, God said, and this is now reading from Bereshith in the beginning, 6:8, I will establish my covenant with you. So if there was any question as to understanding why God said, I picked Noah because he acted appropriately. The way that he engaged and nurtured and supported and acted in his family as a father, as a husband. It was because of that I chose him, emphasizing that what God is prioritizing here is our role in his family, and his family in terms of saving his family. Yahweh is saying right here now, I want to remove any doubt. I want you to have an appreciation that the story I'm telling you is about the covenant. That the story I'm telling you is about my desire to save my children, my covenant children. I want you to know that your relationship, your attitude towards my family is what's going to make the difference. And that your willingness to act upon my instructions, which are found in the Torah, regarding my covenant, is what's going to make the difference in your life, whether you're part of it or not, whether you're saved or not. So Yahweh said, I will establish, I will kum, I will stand up, enabling others to stand, confirming that which will elevate others, causing them to rise, setting up that which is restoring. Ani Bereth, my covenant. Bereth, which is based upon Be'eth, the Hebrew word for family and home. It's a relationship, a marriage vow. It's a partnership, a pledge, a promise, an alliance, an agreement based upon family with you. You've heard the campfire song, Kumbaya. Kum means to stand, to establish. Ba is the Hebrew word for in or with. Yah is the familial version of Yahweh's name. Kumbaya, stand with Yah, be established in Yah. Kumbaya is through the covenant. I will kum, my covenant with you. I will establish my covenant with you. Bereshith 6:8. When we return to Shattering Mist after the commercial break, we will consider the full implications of this stunningly important statement from our Creator so that we know His purpose and His will and how to capitalize upon both. As it relates to this last statement, I will establish my covenant with you, and the verb being kum, I will stand up, enabling others to stand. It brings to mind that two of the most important and misunderstood verbs in the Hebrew scriptures and in the Greek eyewitness accounts are kum in Hebrew and histemi. It's a Greek equivalent, although I don't think histemi is quite the power of kum. One defines the covenant while the other mirrors it. Simply stated, God stood up for us so we could stand with him. That's the whole nature of the covenant relationship. God is like all loving parents. They stand up for their children so that their children can stand with them. They get down on their knees to lift us up. It's the opposite of religion, of course, where we get down on our knees to lift God up, as if God needed our praise or wanted our praise. Now, histemi, the Greek equivalent, provides some interesting insights. You see, on Moriah's steros, the Greek term for the upright pillar, it's Edon in Hebrew. Edon has been corrupted to Adon and to mean Lord, but an Adonai, meaning my Lord. When Edon is used throughout the Torah, expressly and exclusively to describe the upright pillar that is established within the foundation of the tabernacle for the purpose of enlarging and securing its covering. And the Edon speaks of the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh, of Yahusha. Well, on Moriah's steros, which is the upright pillar, it's a word which is derived from histemi, from the verb histemi. And therefore, what we find is that the upright pole is based upon the upright one established within the foundation of Yahweh's tabernacle and there to enlarge and secure God's home. And so we see in this word and in that symbol something that is profound, a link between Qum and Histemi, between Histemi and Steros, that is destroyed when the pagan term cross is used to replace Steros, and when all aspects of the upright one, standing upright for us on the foundation that is the tabernacle and the Torah of God's home, so that we can stand with him, all of that is tossed away by the religious myth of the Christian cross. Now, while we may not be able to pinpoint the exact year of the flood or explain the deluge's every nuance, by diligently investigating the meaning of each term Yahweh selected, we can determine the mind of God. For that alone, your time and mine is well spent. And what we find is that the entire purpose of this was finding a man who acted appropriately within his family, and enabling that man, should that man choose to follow Yahweh's instructions, to act upon Yahweh's guidance, to be able to save his family as a metaphor for Yahweh's family, which is the covenant, which is what God has just confirmed. And if you look at everything that happens from that perspective, that the covenant and the ark are one, and that they're specifically designed to protect a family, and that that is equivalent with us returning back to Eden, where it's a protective enclosure that was conducive to life, that was pure joy in our relationship with God. If you see all of this from that perspective, then you're almost all the way home. That's God's intent. Now, before we move on, I want to emphasize the importance of the Torah's most important declaration. Bereth covenant. This is the first time the word has appeared in the Torah. Bereth is a noun, singular, it's absolute. It is always presented as a noun. It is always presented as being singular. It is always absolute. There is only one covenant. Now, Christian apologists will say, that's not true. You look at the book named Jeremiah, and in the 31st chapter, there's a new and different covenant, not like the existing one. And that's the new covenant, the new testament that is Christianity. Well, that would be an outright lie. God says he's going to reaffirm and renew his one and only covenant, presented in the singular. And that the reaffirmation of his covenant is going to differ from the existing covenant in only one way. And that is that the Torah will literally be placed inside of us by Yahweh. It's the only difference. Right now, we have the opportunity to reject or accept the Torah. That is our choice under the consequence, under the guidance of, under the principle of free will. We have the choice to ignore God's Torah, even hate it as Christians do, to corrupt it as Paul did, as Muhammad did, or to embrace it. You know, Noah was saved because he chose to act upon Yahweh's instructions. Torah means instructions. We have that choice. But once all of those who have lived on this earth prior to Yahweh's return make their choice to either accept or reject Yahweh's Torah guidance, then those who survive, those who are adopted into Yahweh's covenant family, then we, having chosen to be part of God's family, having chosen to respond to and act upon the Torah's instructions. We are given a tremendous gift, one that will enrich us beyond measure. We're given God's guidance directly, literally putting it inside of us so that it will be impossible to corrupt it, it'll be impossible to misunderstand it, it'll be impossible to ignore it, and that we are going to be the beneficiaries of the totality of his insights and guidance. That's his promise. That's what he's saying in Yirmiyahu, in Jeremiah 31. He's not tossing out the Torah to replace it with the gospel of grace. He is reinforcing the Torah, giving it to us as the ultimate gift. So Bereth, it's always singular. It's always absolute because there's only one of them. Just as there is one God and one Torah and one way, there is one covenant. Even though the word appears another 180 times in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it is never plural. There's only one way to the one and only God, Yahweh. And that is through his Bereth covenant. The covenant is the means to salvation. You know, that's another thing that Christians, and we've talked about it so many times in this program, have all wrong. They are of the belief that you are saved first, and then once you are saved, you form a relationship with God and go to heaven and live in his home. That's the opposite of what has to be from any logical, rational, or moral perspective. God presents his covenant as his heart's desire. It is his covenant that provides the means to salvation. Salvation is a byproduct of the covenant. God only saves his covenant children. You notice in this flood, no one outside of Noah's family was saved. It is only his covenant that receives the benefits of salvation. It is the result of the covenant that we are saved. Only those who have acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant, who have responded to Yahweh's instructions as Noah did, are saved, and they are simply the children of God. Religious gremlins who saw fit to copy out of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms by replacing Yahweh's name with the Lord 7,000 times also diminished the magnitude of the covenant by labeling the beginning and end of Yah's testimony Old and New Testaments. Well, there's only one testament. Only one is comprised of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Yahusha did not create a new testament. He simply was and is the living manifestation of the Torah and prophets. That's all he is. He is the Torah and prophets in the flesh. Yahweh is very much alive, and if we want to be, we have to know that he established a covenant, one covenant, which he affirmed many times. There is one God, there is one plan, there is one Noah's Ark, there is one Ark of the Covenant, there is one Torah in which these are presented, and thus there is one way to the one God, whose one and only name is Yahweh. And that is why this is all summarized with one word, Kum. Yahweh stood up for us so that we could stand with him, so that he could establish us upright. Therein, my friends, is the nucleus of God's testimony. It's all about establishing a relationship with our Heavenly Father in a family setting where we stand with him. I bow down to him. We walk with him. We engage with him. We journey through the universe together with him. Even Noah's name, of course, is significant in this regard. He served as a trustworthy guide to the very man whom the covenant would be confirmed, Abraham, who directed us to the man by whom it would be memorialized, Moshe, who spoke of the individual whom would enable its promises, Yahusha, all on behalf of the one and only God, Yahweh. As with the covenant, Noah's salvation would be a family affair. God says to him and to us through him, and you shall be included and come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. This is from In the Beginning, Genesis 6:18. The covenant relationship is based upon family, upon husbands and wives becoming fathers and mothers to bear and raise children. The covenant has been defined. Yahweh says, I'm going to establish Tukum, my covenant with you, and you shall be included and come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Most everyone is familiar with the account which follows. Noah was asked to bring two of every sort of animal, into the ark, a male and female of each life form, along with the food to feed them so that their species would continue to populate the region. And Noah acted upon and engaged doing everything which God had instructed him to do. Bereshith, In the Beginning, 6:22. And therein, my friends, lies the secrets to Noah's salvation and to yours and to mine. And Noah acted upon, engaging in everything God had instructed him to do. We find those instructions the same place Noah found them, in Yahweh's Torah. Immediately after introducing the Torah's single most important term, Bereth, the family-oriented covenant relationship, God unveiled a passage which reveals its basis. It's the standard operating procedure for God. He is a master communicator. Yahweh said to Noah, the trustworthy guide, go, be included into the ark, you and your household, your family. Because indeed, I have seen that those with you are upright, tzedak, righteous, vindicated, innocent, by means of my presence in this home, door. Wow, what a great statement. Yahweh, which is God's one and only name. Yahweh's name itself embodies the nature of the covenant. If you read Yahweh's name in the language that the Torah was, the alphabet, I should say. The language, of course, is Hebrew. But in the alphabet, the Torah was written. This Paleo-Hebrew. What you find is that Yahweh's name is comprised of four letters, all four of which are vowels. And those four letters, the first of which is a hand reaching down and out to us, an open hand, a hand so as to cum, lift us up and establish us so that we can stand. And that hand that Yahweh is reaching down and out to us is reaching out to two people, mother and father. Could be Sarah and Abraham, the first to participate in the embodiment of the Torah's covenant, or could be Noah and his wife, could be Adam and Chawa. But man and woman standing side by side, reaching up, looking up to God, standing in God's presence is the very embodiment of this name. And between the two individuals is the tent peg, the means to secure and enlarge not only them individually by way of the covenant's promises, but also the family of God. That's Yahweh's name. Yahweh said, Amar, promised to Noah, the trustworthy guide, go, bo, enter, be included into God's, El's, ark, the Almighty's ark. You and all of your household, Be'eth, Be'eth is the basis of Bereth. Family, home, household. You see, the covenant is a family-oriented relationship. Be'eth. Because indeed, this is trustworthy, reliable. I have seen, I have perceived, I have considered. God's perceptions of what counts when it relates to our righteousness, that those with you are upright. You see, if the Father is upright, if the Father is righteous, if the Father is teaching his children what Yahweh has taught him, then it influences everyone within the home. And so, not only was Noah upright, but so was his wife. So were his sons. So were his sons' wives. That is the beauty of the covenant. It's the beauty of God's guidance. Tzedak is the word, of course, that completely undermines Paul. Paul would say that none are righteous, no, not one. He would say that the Torah is incapable of making a person righteous. Well, the Hebrew word for righteous is tzedak. It means righteous, vindicated, upright, vindicated, innocent. Powerful term. God is saying here that because Noah was appropriate within his family, because Noah did what God had encouraged him to do, because Noah engaged and acted upon Yahweh's instructions, that he and his family were righteous, at least from God's perspective. You know, you look at Dod, the best example of a man whom God calls righteous, whom we know is David. You know, he had lots of warts. I mean, the man was a zillion miles from being a perfect citizen. But from God's perspective, which is the only one that matters as it relates to us being adopted into his home and declared innocent, from God's ra'ah, from his perceptions, Dod was perfect because he also observed Yah's Torah. He listened to Yah's instructions. He acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant. And therefore, from God's perspective, he was perfect, just as was Noah and his family. That they are upright, that they are vindicated, that they are righteous, tzedak, by means of Yahweh's presence in the home throughout the generations. Dor means dwelling place. It means sheltered encampment. It means generation. It means time. It means home. It means protective enclosure. It's a powerful term. But Yahweh was saying that Noah and his family weren't righteous. They weren't upright because of their own doing, but because of God's perceptions of them by Yahweh's means, through Yahweh's presence. And Yahweh's presence here on earth in a corporeal means is through Yahusha, who enabled the first four Moed Mikre, which enabled the promises of the covenant, which make us perfect in his eyes.